Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate welcomes Norman Lebrecht to discuss his book, Why Beethoven, A Phenomenon in 100 Pieces. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we've got Norman Lebrecht, the author of Why Beethoven, A Phenomenon in 100 Pieces. Norman, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
This is a wonderful book. Beethoven's a little bit outside our wheelhouse. I'm not going to pretend to be a classical music aficionado or romantic music, I should technically say, I guess. But I have been a fan of Beethoven since, this is embarrassing too, since I saw Clockwork Orange as a 11-year-old, which says something about the way children were raised in the 70s and 80s. But this is a
You're probably reading the Peanut strip. He was a fan of Beethoven too.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Linus was always shouting out Beethoven, and that definitely got my attention because I was reading Peanuts for sure. And this is a wonderful book. Tell us about the genesis of the book and what the book project is, essentially.
It's called Why Beethoven, but it's about life. It's about everything. About a dozen years ago, I wrote a book called Why Mahler, because this was a phenomenon that was unique in music history. Gustav Mahler was a composer who was derided in his lifetime, virtually ignored for half a century afterwards, and then returned to become the center of symphonic conversation. How did that happen? How had perspectives shifted so greatly? What was it about Mahler that made him unknowable in his time and relevant to our times? When it came to Beethoven, the reverse applies. Beethoven was instantly recognized as the most important thing in music. When he came to Vienna at 21 years old, everybody just stood aghast. And that this is the future of music. They said, it's the next Mozart. And Beethoven said, no, it isn't. I'm not Mozart. I'm not going down that route at all. And he set out to be as different from Mozart as he could possibly be. In the first place, confronting and affronting many of the rich people who had been Mozart's patrons by saying, I don't have to take your money. I choose who I accept as my sponsors, which is a complete revolution in music. So how is it that somebody can be so assured of his destiny and his destiny to be so essential, so vital, that even today, we are sometimes still struggling for meaning in some of the works that Beethoven wrote. I've lived with Beethoven for much of my life, pretty much since childhood. But the most intense engagement came when I started to write this book, and it was the beginning of the COVID lockdown. And I realized that Beethoven had spent much of his life in lockdown. From the age of 30, he was deaf. Most of his social relationships were shut down by his inability to hear, his inability to communicate. People would write something in his conversation book, and he would write something back, but that's not satisfactory at all. So Beethoven had a kind of parallel lockdown, and re-listening to his music, rereading his music through those extraordinary life-constricting conditions of the pandemic was almost a new shining pathway into them of seeing what it is like to live almost completely alone. Why Beethoven is not a question. Why Beethoven is a statement. We need him now more than ever.
I'd have to agree. I found this to be an incredibly powerful book. For one thing, this was the first book I've read that seemed to have processed the COVID experience that we all went through. It was this massive shared trauma that seems to have been memory-holed and forgotten as we plunge back into commerce and spending and doing. And it needs to be remembered because it was...
We so want to forget it, don't we?
Yes.
At the beginning of COVID, I went looking for books about the Spanish flu of the pandemic of 1918 to 1921, in which more people were killed than in the First World War. And there is hardly anything in any language known to me written about the subject, because people just wanted to wipe it out. They'd been through a horrible thing, and they didn't want to look back at it. And we're feeling that way about the COVID pandemic now.
Yes, we are. But Beethoven, on the other hand, we do like to look back at. And the structure of your book, because it's not only, it's not a, you know, it's a chapter by chapter analysis of a lot of his work. But you, it's also functions as sort of a pocket biography of Beethoven, or it tells much of his life story, retells much of his life story. But describe the actual project. You initially, it's the book is a survey of all the recorded versions of Beethoven works that we have, but tell us how you boiled that down so it was a functional, something, a project that you could pull off.
It wasn't that difficult. I mean, there are a number of ways that you can approach Beethoven. The biography essentially is uninteresting. He's born in Bonn. He leaves at the age of 21, and he never goes back. He stays in Vienna the rest of his life. He will go for his summer holidays in the woods in what is now the Czech Republic. But otherwise, he doesn't travel at all. He has no curiosity. He has no need to travel. One of the ways that I approached Beethoven was to ask myself not what he did, but what he didn't do. One of the first things he didn't do, he never went to the sea. I mean, can you imagine? No curiosity, no urge to dabble his toes in the waves. He never went to the sea. He never traveled anywhere. He didn't need to, because his entire world was interiorized, and that was all he needed in order to make the music. So to discover Beethoven, you discover him not from the biography, and to a degree not even from the things he scribbled in the conversation books or the anecdotes that are told about him, many of which are spurious, but from what is actually inside and what he is putting down as notes on the page. Over the last decade, we've been very fortunate. Many of Beethoven's manuscripts have been digitized. So even in COVID lockdown, I could go online and I could follow Beethoven's hand down the page, and I could see the hesitations, the erasures, the second thoughts, the way in which Beethoven, normally so secure about what he's doing, suddenly gets stuck and thinks, no, not this way. Breaks off, doesn't want to continue with this work, maybe come back to it later. The letters that he wrote to people, those things, that's where Beethoven emerges, and in the music itself. Now, the music it's there on the page, but even more so, it's there in 100 years of recording. So we have to look at how other great musical minds have conceived of Beethoven over the course of slightly more than a century. And if I just give one example, let's just take a look at the Russians. There was a brilliant piano teacher in Moscow called Heinrich Neuhaus. He was himself a phenomenal Beethoven pianist, and he had 4-star pupils, all of whom recorded almost the whole of Beethoven. Two of the names are very well known, Emil Gilels, Sviatoslav Richter. Two others were hardly ever allowed to leave Russia, if at all, and they were Maria Grinberg and Maria Yudina. All four are pupils of Neuhaus. You listen to them play something like the Opus 111, the 32nd Piano Sonata, the second movement, and you can hardly believe they're playing the same work. each has applied an interpretation to the notes, to the spaces between the notes, to the phrasing, to the dynamics that makes the work sound completely different from the other three pianists, but also from the recording of their teacher Neuhaus. So what you realize through this is that Beethoven music is not a very accurate art. It's an approximate art. To notate music is only to give a vague idea of what's going through the composer's head. In this case, these phenomenal interpreters have almost created new works in the way that they approached and recorded the Opus 111. Take that then across the whole spectrum of Beethoven's works, and we're talking about 250 works.
If I can jump in, Norman, I wanted to play our first song snippet. And 30 seconds is just not a great way to introduce bits of Beethoven. But what I wanted to do was focus on the Fifth Symphony, since it's the most well-known piece, and you talk about it extensively. And I wanted, and it was also fairly easy to find four 30-second pieces that are impactful. And this is the famous opening of the Fifth Symphony, as recorded by Carlos Kleber with the Philharmonica in 1975, which is widely believed to be one of the best recorded versions of the Fifth Symphony. Let's hear how he opened the famous symphony. And that was Carlos Kleber conducting the Philharmonica in 1975 in a piece that's widely regarded as one of the best recorded versions of the Fifth Symphony. And Norman, this book also functions as a mini biography of many of these musicians, because we learn about Kleber and his father, Eric. You mentioned the four Russian pianists. There's the German conductors, some of whom, Eric Kleber was famously anti-Nazi, but some of the composers we discussed were pro-Nazi, who went on to very successful careers pro-World War II. It's a very fascinating introduction to a whole cast of characters beyond Beethoven. But I wanted to zero in on one aspect of his personality, which was his relationships to the nobles. And then the opening piece, you're talking about the Pathetique, which, as an aside, you had to share this quote: more people learn to hate Beethoven from being taught this sonata than from any other cause. And I could identify with that from my very unsuccessful piano lessons. But in that chapter, you describe his relationship with Prince Lichnowsky, who was one of Mozart's patrons, and is widely considered to be one of the people who ruined Mozart, that he sued Mozart for money shortly before Mozart's death, and that was a contributing factor. Can you give a quick capsule version of the relationship between Beethoven and Lichnowsky and Beethoven's famous parting bon mot to the prince?
Well, Beethoven comes to Vienna, and very quickly there are people who want to know him and want his music, and they want to have their name on his music, because if you are an idle rich man, the only way you can secure, the best way to secure posterity is by getting your name onto a piece of music by the greatest living composer. I mean, you know, there is Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata. Who would ever remember Count Waldstein if he hadn't paid for a sonata? So one of the first to come after Beethoven was Karl Lichnowsky, and Beethoven knew there was something fishy about Lichnowsky. Lichnowsky was court chamberlain at the imperial court in Vienna. It's a very, very important position. According to some documents, he was also head or deputy head of the secret police. He had some dark connections. He'd been Mozart's patron, but there had been a falling out, and Lichnowsky sued Mozart in court for money that he claimed to have lent him. Mozart lost, and weeks later was dead. So there is a bit of a shadow around Lichnowsky, but Lichnowsky comes over to Beethoven. He's a young man. He's 21 years old and embraces him and says, look, I have this wonderful mansion. Come and live in my mansion. I will give you as many rooms as you like, and I will buy you some instruments. He actually bought him 2 Stradivari violins and a viola, and and you can play the best pianos in Vienna. And in the ballroom downstairs, you can give concerts, and you will have no expenses at all. You can eat the best food in the mansion, and make yourself entirely at home. And Beethoven initially accepted this. And then he realized that the life of luxury was possibly not the place where he wanted to live, because in Vienna it was also the lap of debauchery. It is said, and we can't prove this, it is said that Lichnowsky could only ever have relations with his wife in a brothel. They would arrange to meet in a brothel on Thursday night, and that was the only place where he could achieve arousal. This kind of atmosphere spread into his lodgings. There are reports that a couple of his associates offered Beethoven to have sex with their wives, and Beethoven didn't want any of it, and he moved out, and that was it. And the relationship was fraying, where at a certain point he'd agreed to play at a country that Lichnowsky went to for long weekends. And he looked out into the audience and saw that there were a lot of French army officers. The French were occupying Vienna at that time. Beethoven did not like that, and he did not like people who collaborated with the enemy. And after he had performed the Second Symphony, which was dedicated to Lichnowsky, Lichnowsky said to him, now come on, dear Beethoven, play something new. And Beethoven said, basically, I'm sorry, I don't take requests. And Lichnowsky said, well, you know who I am, and you know I'm really, you really ought to meet the request that I'm making of you. Beethoven at this point got up, took the piano stool, threw it into the audience, and ran out into the night. It was a stormy night. He walked 6 miles to the nearest town. He saw a sign showing where the doctor lived. He banged on his door. The doctor let him in, and he slept the night there, and in the morning he took a carriage back to Vienna. And when the prince came back to Vienna, he summoned Beethoven. Beethoven didn't come. The prince had to go around to Vienna and demanded an apology. Had to go around to Beethoven and demanded an apology, and Beethoven refused. And the prince said, you know, come on, Beethoven, you can't behave like that to my guests. Beethoven said, there are many princes in the world. There's only one Beethoven. And that remark went viral in Vienna. Everybody realized that a musician who lived on his music and on his wits had stood up to one of the most powerful men in the empire and showed him the door, basically. And nothing happened to him. Nobody could touch him, because he was right. He was Beethoven. What happened from there on is even more interesting. Prince had a younger brother, a count.
If I can jump in and interrupt you with another song snippet, and then we'll come back and tell the story of your younger brother. So this is again from the same performance of the Fifth by Carlos Kleiber with the Philharmonica. And this is the Andante, which you say yields a brief relief, like coffee in an interrogation room. And that, again, was from Carlos Kleiber's version of the Fifth Symphony, recorded in 1975 with the Philharmonica Orchestra. And this was the Andante. And so back to the younger brother of the prince.
So Beethoven is then approached by the prince's younger brother, Count Moritz Lichnowsky. Relations between the two brothers are not great. Moritz says to him, I hear you've sacked my brother. Would it be all right if I commissioned a couple of pieces from you? Beethoven said, with pleasure. I choose who my sponsors are. And I became quite friendly with the younger brother. Eventually, time moves on, Prince Karl Lichnowsky falls from power, and he's getting on in years. And one day, Beethoven is sitting composing, and he sees the prince walking up the road towards his cottage. And so he gets up and slams the door shut. Prince comes banging on the door, nobody answers. Sits down on the stone steps outside, waits a couple of hours, nobody comes out, so he goes home. Next day, same scenario. Keeps on coming, keeps on knocking at the door. Finally, Beethoven opens the door and says, "What do you want?" And Prince Lichnowsky says to him, I just want you to say good morning to me." Beethoven says, "Good morning, thank you, goodbye." He has completely rewritten the relationship between music and money and power. The power now lies in the hands of the creative forces of the musicians. The rest just have to follow.
Yeah, it's an incredible, I hadn't realized any of that context, and it's an incredible pivot point in the relationship of individuals to the fuel, the ancient regime, the fuel system, the money, the power. And also one thing that was fascinating, I knew that Beethoven was likely celibate or a virgin his entire life, but I didn't realize the context, and I had sort of written him off as a prude. But when you so vividly portray the frankly disgustingly decadent environment in Vienna, in which some of his fellow musicians were selling their preteen children to predatory members of the aristocracy, it suddenly becomes very clear why Beethoven was so repulsed by this. And as a romantic in the sense we usually use romantic, not this other sense in which he was a romantic, the Byronic sense, but it suddenly becomes this moral stand, and his quest for love was also, you know, he was really focused on his art. It's fascinating to compare him to somebody like Liszt or any of the rock stars I cover on this, where there's a concept I call kind of the Orpheus tax. And every great musician seems to pay it. And Beethoven didn't have the wild living. He wasn't, you know, profligate. He didn't have, you know, a big rise and sudden fall. He didn't have those kind of, he had this very contained life. But the deafness is obviously, there's where he paid. He's so isolated. And yet he rose through it. And describe his work life and how he focused strictly on his art.
I mean, it's worth just pausing for a moment on his attitude to sex and love.
Absolutely.
One of the that Beethoven, when I asked myself, what did Beethoven not do? He never made love. He never had sex within a relationship, and quite possibly never had sex at all. There are hints that he may have once gone to a brothel on a dare with a friend, but there is also no confirmation that he had intercourse with any of the occupants. Beethoven's attitude to sex was unnecessary. He was so totally dedicated to making art, to making music, to bringing out what he had in himself, that he didn't want that kind of connection with another human being. He liked being in love. He loved being in love. Sometimes he needed to be in love, but he always chose women who were unattainable, who were of the aristocracy, who were never going to be allowed to marry a musician of the lower classes. And so love for Beethoven was an ideal. It was never a physical intimacy. Everything had to be dedicated towards his pursuit of the music. There have been an awful lot written and an awful lot filmed about Beethoven's romantic life and about the search for the unattainable beloved. But every time you start researching into what really went on, you find there was no beloved there. I mean, you hear, even today, you hear pianists talk of Beethoven writing that ubiquitous little ringtone piece, Für Elise, for one of his distant beloveds. It wasn't. And the name, I've been able to prove that Beethoven never knew anybody called Elise. The name was supplied by someone else altogether. So Beethoven's purpose in life was to make music and to make music for everyone. He never saw music as being the domain of the privileged or the domain of the rich. Everything he did was geared to making music for the widest possible audience. He wasn't concerned about wealth and privilege. He wanted to bring music to everyone. One of the most striking things is when it comes to the premiere of the Ninth Symphony, the biggest work ever written at that time, people said to him, Beethoven, what do you think you're doing? You're putting it on a Friday when all the wealthy people in Vienna have gone out to their country homes, and they're hunting and shooting and fishing and doing whatever else you do in country homes. And there's going to be no audience of quality to hear your Ninth Symphony. And Beethoven said, good, I want it to be for the people. And of course, the message that comes over from the Ninth Symphony is that all of us are brothers. All of us are one of the same. His relationships with individuals was never geared to status. He could value someone according to who they are, according to what they did, rather than according to who they were.
And let's go ahead and take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll talk about the Fifth Symphony and its origins. Mm.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
So Norman, you go through a lot of the works in the book, but I want to zero in on the Fifth Symphony because it's the most well-known piece, and it's also one I think we can discuss to some satisfaction in the short period of time we have left. And you talk about one of your quotes is that little that Beethoven did penetrated on first hearing, yet musicians and public understood that it was somehow exalted, existing on a plane higher than anyone else's. Is that true of the famous Fifth Symphony with the opening motif? It seems to me like that would have made an immediate sense to anyone with ears. Was that not the case at the time?
That was the case. That was the case. The Fifth Symphony had, the Fifth and Sixth Symphonies, which were premiered together, had instant impact. People understood that this is music that they could relate to, and it seemed to relate also to the time they were in, which was the time of the Napoleonic Wars, when armies were rampaging across Europe and the whole social order was being turned upside down. So it provided almost an oracle for where the world was going. But the question always was how to perform them. I mean, you think the opening of the Fifth Symphony, da-da-da-dum, that ought to be fairly easy. Well, no two performances are the same. And many of them sound really quite weird to our ears. The earliest recording was made by a man called Arthur Nikisch in a box room in Berlin in 1913. And that has a kind of stentorian sound, a kind of summons that seems credible. But an awful lot of others they're just so variable. They're all over the place, and it was very difficult. People said, well, can you recommend me a recording? It was really, really difficult until in 1975, a man called Carlos Kleiber came along, and he was hardly known. His father, Erich Kleiber, was well known, but this is a young man who's just cutting his teeth as a major conductor, and he produces a recording of the Fifth Symphony in Vienna, which strikes almost everyone as immaculate. Now, how does one explain that? How is it that 150 years go by since Beethoven died, and it's taken all that time for one person to come along and grasp that symphony whole in a manner that all of us can stand back and say, this is it. What is it that happened in the transaction between this young man, Carlos Kleiber, who was, his father was German, his mother was American, he was born in Argentina, English was his first language. And what actually happened? And this is one of the great mysteries of music, that every now and then, no matter how often you go to concerts, how often you hear performances, every now and then, you will hear a performance that sounds absolutely right. Equally, every now and then you will hear a performance that sounds absolutely wrong. But music is fluid. It's impossible to trap it. It's a continuing process. It reflects the world around it. There is a recording of the Fifth Symphony by the Berlin Philharmonic conductor, Wilhelm Furtwängler, towards the end of the Nazi regime, in which you can practically hear the walls of Berlin falling. You understand that the regime is crumbling and the war is about to end. How is it possible that Beethoven's symphony, in this case actually it was the violin concerto, how is it possible that Beethoven's violin concerto can capture so precisely the atmosphere in late 1944, early 1945? Just it's because Beethoven gave us the template. Beethoven gave a template that can actually respond to everything that we are experiencing today in the summer of 2023.
And one thing I thought was fascinating, like I said, you tell the story of not just Beethoven, but also many of the musicians who've interpreted his work. Tell us a little about how Carlos Kleiber related to the symphonic music business in Europe in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. This guy wrote his own ticket. Tell us what he did, and how did he pull it off?
It's a one-off story. Carlos Kleiber had a difficult relationship with his father. His father had been a successful conductor of modern music in Germany before Hitler came to power. He gave the first performance of what's regarded as the first great modernist opera, Wozzeck, in Berlin in 1926. There were 126 rehearsals in order to get this work on the stage with a modicum of accuracy. So his father was a great trailblazer. He was a really interesting and important conductor, but he went into exile in Argentina, the other end of the world. He wasn't Jewish. He went into exile as a matter of principle and protest against the Hitler regime. And when he came back to Europe after the war, practically nobody wanted to know him. So his last years were really pretty miserable. And Carlos, he did everything he possibly could to prevent his son Carlos from becoming a conductor. And Carlos became a conductor despite this. But very often what he did as a conductor was a kind of counterpoint to his father's life. So he became a conductor, but he refused to take any jobs. He didn't want to be music director anywhere. He became a freelance conductor. And because he was so gifted and so interesting and so engaged with the musicians derived so much from what he did with them, he was constantly in demand and able to obtain the highest fees. So it was said of him that he only ever conducted when his refrigerator was empty. He conducted almost at whim, and he canceled more often than he conducted. So he lived this almost vagrant life, conducting when he pleased, recording when he chose, living for the most part on a mountaintop in Slovenia, communicating with very, very few friends, very few indeed. I mean, he had half a dozen friends around the world, again, taken from different strata of society, with whom he wrote letters in English. And eventually, like his father, despaired and took his own life. It's an extraordinary life, and it's a life that is best expressed by the work that he did in Beethoven and the recordings that he made of Beethoven. So for to be able to reflect the achievement of this extraordinarily gifted musician through the legacy of Beethoven's extraordinary music, it seemed to me a story worth telling.
Indeed. And let's hear a little bit from his third movement, which reprises the opening theme. This is again from the Carlos Kleber, a 1975 recording with the Philharmonica in Vienna. That was the opening of the third movement from Carlos Kleber's version of this Fifth Symphony of Beethoven, recorded in 1975 with the Vienna Philharmonica. And it's so funny because, you know, on this show, we've talked about blues artists, we've talked about hip-hop artists, rock stars, jazz musicians, a little bit of classical. And Kleber sounds so much like the blues artist Jimmy Reed or John Lee Hooker, who would only perform or sign a record deal when they were broke. And he's also kind of like a mini Beethoven who's writing his own ticket and very much declaring his independence. And you know, you talk about a stunt he pulled where he rehearsed with an orchestra and set out on a tour and quit halfway and yet was rehired to do it again, which in the rock music world, Neil Young's the only one I can think of to do that. So it's just fascinating to me, these parallels. Musicians are musicians, no matter the genre, it seems, and find their own way because of their personal prowess.
Completely, completely unpredictable. A record company hired him to record the opera Wozzeck, which was his father's creation, at a cost of $1 million in the 1980s. And Kleber decided who was going to be in the cast and everything. It was all done to his satisfaction. He didn't show up for the recording. Money was lost. And the record company then went after him and tried to get him to record something else. Just everybody wanted a part of this person because he was a unique object. He was a unique artist, as indeed was Beethoven. And you know when you're standing in the presence of a one-off or when you're listening to a one-off and you are enhanced by it.
Absolutely. And this book is full of one-offs. There's so many musicians that you introduced me to and so many versions you introduced me to. And you also sort of, it's widely known, I guess, but the opening motif of the Fifth Symphony, that's something that Beethoven had included in another piece. It appears before his final encapsulation, and he does this again with other themes that he's going to use again. Talk about that. How did Beethoven, you know, organize his work such that he was able to elaborate on little themes and ideas from smaller pieces and build them into bigger and bigger pieces as he went on?
Things come and go in Beethoven, and you really need to look at the music in its totality, to get an idea of the world that he inhabited. I mean, yes, the opening of the Fifth Symphony, is found in a little piece for one piano, four hands, that he wrote in his teens. Well, clearly that theme stayed in his unconscious all those years and popped out in the Fifth Symphony. There are other things that come up in one of the late quartets. You suddenly hear, out of nowhere, the Jewish prayer, Kol Nidre. Now, Beethoven was not Jewish. He hadn't heard any Jewish music in his deafness, but he might, as a teenager, you go back and you trace it. And I found that there was a tiny synagogue in Bonn when he was where he was growing up as a teenager. And it's possible that on one summer's evening at the start of Yom Kippur, he heard this tune and it stayed in his mind, and it pops up in almost one of the last works that he writes, not for any specific purpose, but because it feeds into the stream of thought that he is pursuing in this particular late quartet. I should tell you that the late quartets were considered unplayable during his lifetime. They were hardly done in Vienna at all. They only received their first real performances in London in the 1840s. And the man behind them was the co-owner of the Times newspaper, who'd been trying to play them with three friends at home. So the way that you trace the evolution of Beethoven and his music, it takes so many paths, and there are so many stories, and there are so many ways in which it feeds into all kinds of music today that you're looking at a world entire.
And I'm going to play our last song snippet, and we're going to switch it up and play and hear from the father, Eric Kleiber's version of the Symphony No. 5. And this is from a 1953 recording of the Fifth Symphony conducted by Eric Kleiber. And as you say, it is as if Carlos wins every battle, only for his father to win the war. The scherzo are restrained and all power held in reserve for the lightning strike finale of devastating, irremediable savagery. Let's hear some irremediable savagery. Was Eric Kleiber playing the conducting the Fifth Symphony in 1953, and as you say, a finale of devastating, irremediable savagery. And any heavy metal fan would react to that. This is just immensely powerful, straight in your face music. But as you say, you said something fascinating that I wanted to get you elaborate on. You said that Beethoven was not so much disorganized as a willful organizer of musical chaos. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, he lived in circumstances of the most terrible squalor. He changed home quite often, and if you went into his room, everything would be scattered around, and there would be a bad smell. There was someone reports of a visit to Beethoven that there was an unemptied chamber pot beneath the seat on which he was sitting and composing. He didn't want people to visit him. He didn't want people to waste his time. So he kept his own circumstances in such a way that would deter people from coming by. He reveled in chaos because in music he was constantly pursuing order. He was looking for solutions. He was looking to find a way beyond the music of today and a way beyond the music of this planet. Often when you go into the late works, you actually think that Beethoven is taking leave of this earth and going out somewhere into the spheres. And it's as though this world is full of chaos and corruption, and only at some distance from this world, somewhere out there in space, in eternity, can he help us to make sense of it. He was hopeless in his personal relationships. He when he came to conduct the Ninth Symphony, a couple of friends came around and said, where's your conducting jacket? He didn't have one. He didn't have any jacket except some horrible green thing with patches in it. So they had to scavenge around and find a jacket for him to conduct one of the greatest works of Western civilization, the Ninth Symphony, All Men Shall Be Brothers.
And you talk about the debut of the Fifth Symphony, in which it was a complete fiasco, where he's knocking candles off the piano stand.
He couldn't hear by this time. The only way you could hear was by bending down and putting his ear as close as possible to the floorboards so that he could feel the vibrations coming off the floor, and from the vibrations somehow feel the music, get some sensory stimulus of the music and know where the players actually were. The concertmaster, the leading violinist, would say to the players beforehand, don't watch him, watch me. Don't follow his beat, because he's all over the place. He can't hear a thing. I mean, it's one of the great tragedies that this phenomenal creator of music could not hear the music he created.
Yeah, and yet he was so productive and methodical. I mean, he really just focused his life on writing music and living in this interior world. And as he became deaf and his social world shrank, his musical world expanded. And there's this contradiction. I want to throw two of your quotes at you and get you to sort of untangle the contradiction. On the one hand, you say that his genius was instantly recognized and lastingly acknowledged. Mm-hmm. But you also say that little that he did penetrated on first hearing, yet musicians and public both understood that it was somehow exalted, existing on a plane higher than anyone else's. Untangle that. Like how could that be? Did people just intuit that something was going on without actually understanding the music until later?
This is extremely rare in the history of civilization. I think if you want a parallel, it's probably Leonardo da Vinci. People looked at his sketches and they looked at his inventions. They didn't know where they come from and where they came from, and they didn't know what they meant. When Leonardo invented what we know today as photography, nobody in his time realized what it was or what it might be. They just knew that Leonardo was this phenomenal mind who applied a kind of an artistic sensibility to the invention of new technology. It was a similar thing with Beethoven. They didn't understand the music that he made. Every now and then he would please them with a little dance movement, and they'd say, oh, we like that. Yes, it sets the feet tapping. Oh, yeah, we could probably get out on the floor and have a little twirl with that. But the entirety of a piece of music, a whole symphony, it was above their heads. They didn't know it. What they knew, what they recognized, was that Beethoven was operating at a level just above the understanding of his time. Everybody would sort of reach higher and higher and higher in order to grasp Beethoven, and he was just beyond that. It's very, very hard for me to find any parallel apart from Leonardo. But the two go well together, because if you look at the four pillars on which Western civilization rests, you would very quickly come to a consensus that they were Leonardo, Michelangelo, Shakespeare, Beethoven. Take away any of those, and the whole of what we know as culture and civilization collapses. There are very few names that you could add to that set that would be of a comparable contribution to civilization. So you're talking here, when you're talking about Beethoven, you're talking of somebody who made the world that we live in today, who, whatever kind of music that you like, whatever it is that you read, whatever art that it is that you've seen, has been in some way or other influenced by this extraordinary individual who died in 1827. And to know that, to discover more of him through the music, to bring him to a wider audience, well, that's why I wrote the book, Why Beethoven.
And well said. And you also say something. You say that we owe him the gratitude we pay to the greatest of our species. And when you were writing this book, there were some calls to quote unquote cancel Beethoven. And while I'm sympathetic, very sympathetic as an American, I've seen American police state racism firsthand over and over throughout my life. And I'm sympathetic to people who feel drowned out by dead white men and the cultural legacy. But at the same time, you framed Beethoven as kind of a bulwark of the best of Western civilization, that when people call to cancel Beethoven, it's just not happening. I'm sorry. You know, like, describe that. How did Beethoven like sort of shelter the rest of Western civilization behind his noble brow?
Well, it's exactly that. I mean, there was one academic who, in agitating for Beethoven to be cancelled, said, well, he's just above average. You know, he's no better than any number of black composers, which is a proposition that's so ridiculous, not because of the comparison, but the idea that Beethoven is just above average, that it just got laughed out of court. You can't fail to recognize the way in which Beethoven steps out of the ordinary. He is never ordinary. Even trivial pieces have something that will surprise you, have something that will open your eyes and open your ears. So to get caught in the current wave of cancel culture, which I think, by the way, is receding now.
Yes, quite.
It's unfortunate. Is unfortunate, but it leaves no lasting stain on Beethoven's work.
Definitely not. Definitely not. And I want to wrap with two quotes from you, that you express thankfulness for a wayward genius who walks on unpaved paths and brings dirt into the house. Elaborate on that just a little bit.
Well, he does. There is something. There is something incredibly human about Beethoven and the way that he writes music and the his lack of regard for convention, his lack of regard for courtesy, and the fact that, yes, he often has muck on his shoes and he tramps it into the house. He will go out for a walk with a couple of people and they'll be having a very nice time in the country, in the meadows, and they'll stop for a beer somewhere, and then he'll come back home. I mean, he won't be hearing much of what they're saying. If any communication will be in the little conversation book, he'll come back home and he will say to them, okay, you can go now. I've got to compose that. So whatever it was that had happened that afternoon, a work has been forming in his mind, and he's going to bring everything. He's going to bring the birds and the smells of the countryside and the babbling of the brook and everything else. It's all going to come in some form, possibly mutated, in the work that he is creating. He is there as a creative machine. Everything that he experiences in life is then going to be turned into the music of the spheres.
Absolutely. And I'll wrap with this quote. I'm not going to ask you to reply to this. I think this says everything. There are no losers, no winners, no victims or avengers, no greed or grudges. Only an eruptive collective delight in being alive and human at this climactic moment in music, experiencing together the best of all possible worlds. And so, Norman, the book is Why Beethoven. My guest has been Norman Lebrecht. And thank you so much for the education you've given me on Beethoven. And I hope many of our listeners will join in, because it's an incredible body of work. And I think you've introduced it. You've made the symphonic catalog, or the recorded catalog of Beethoven, quite digestible, and this book is a great guide to attack the canon, I think. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate and Ned Sublett continue the Latin Roll miniseries. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.